Hello and welcome to Behind the Screams. As always, my name is Ian, and in today's show, I am joined by a very special guest. He is making his debut on the Behind the Screams podcast. You know him on Twitter and on Twitch as Coyote Wildfire. We know him as Jade. Jade, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing really well. Any day north of the daisies is a great day.
So I know we've talked, obviously, a little bit about just before we came onto the show, a little bit off air. How are things going in your part of the world? How are things doing with you? People obviously know that one of our previous guest hosts, Laurie, is your good lady wife as well. How are things for the both of you just now?
Well, I mean, we're well on our way right now. Our primary goal, from a personal standpoint, is to work towards a down payment for a house. I mean, with the whole scenario as this started back in 2018, I mean, she was living in England. So when, you know, we embarked on this, we knew that we had a lot of road to travel. So we've gotten through immigration, which has been awesome. You know, she's been living with me for a little over a year. We were married last year, streamed that on Twitch as well. And as it stands right now, our next step and our next big goal is really, you know, finding a home of our own.
That's so awesome. And obviously, I said this to you off the air as well, but I really, really do wish you absolutely all the best, you and Laurie, because for those who maybe haven't came across you guys on your Twitch or your social medias, who's maybe listening to podcasts, these are literally two of the nicest people you could absolutely come across. So if you can, go and give them some support across their social medias, across their Twitch, and across any of their endeavors, please go and do so, because I don't think I've ever came across two more deserving people.
Thank you so much. I mean, that's such a kind thing to say. I'm really humbled. Whenever I go live, you know, the fact that I could play video games and scream at a camera because things aren't going my way, and then talk to people because text shows up in my chat. I mean, I can't think of a nerdier thing to do.
But I mean, you're saying this to a person who runs a horror movie review podcast, so I definitely get nerdiness.
you and me, we might have something in common here. I like horror and video games. You like horror. I mean, this is good.
Yes, I think we're cut from the same cloth, really.
Yours might be a little more Scottish.
Just a little bit. There's a bit more tartan in my cloth. Awesome. So don't forget, everyone, you can find this show in a variety of places. We are available across all major podcasting platforms. Find us on Twitter at ScreamsBehind. Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube is at Behind the Screams Podcast. You can also find us now on our very own website. Just go to btspod.wixsite.com/btspod. I know that's a tongue twister. Don't worry. That's across all of our social medias and in the description for this episode. There you can find updates on what's coming up on the show. We've got all of our blog review entries from our resident written critic, Melissa. You can also find details on our Patreon there as well. Talking of our Patreon, go to patreon.com/behindthescreams. You can subscribe to us from as little as £1 a month, and our rewards vary from everything to shout outs on the show, which we will do at the end of the show, all the way up to actually guest appearing on the show. But in between, you know, we do a lot of bonus episodes up there. We've got three different series of bonus episodes currently up on our Patreon as well. So please do consider going and supporting us there on the Patreon. That's patreon.com/behindthescreams. Jade, do you want to tell our listeners where they can find your Twitch, where they can find your socials as well?
Sure. So I'm pretty much anywhere you can use Google. If you type in Coyote Wildfire, you'll find me primarily on Twitch. I'm live Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 11 p.m. UK time and 2 p.m. Pacific time. And I'm a variety streamer, so I mean, it depends on the flavor of the week, but same place, same time.
Awesome. Yep, I do absolutely encourage everyone to go and check out Jade's streams, because they are a huge amount of fun. Okay, so are you ready to get into our first segment of the show?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we are talking about our horror questions of the week. So for those who don't know, across our social medias, mainly on Twitter, every day or every other day, I'll put out little tidbits of horror questions just to sort of get a general feel for what people think about various different aspects of horror. Now, obviously, Jade, because this is your first ever appearance on the show, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that we've asked some of our other guest hosts before, just so that some of our listeners can get a little bit of a feel for where your sort of taste level is at horror and where, you know, your sort of horror loyalty lies.
Gotcha.
So, question number one. What is your favorite subgenre of horror?
Psychological horror, easily.
Oh, that wasn't even... You didn't even need a second to think about that. So what are some of your favorite psychological horror movies?
So I believe that my exposure primarily has been in the video game arena more than it has been in movies. So I guess... If I were to put it out there, it is because I'm drawing parallels to the game in and of itself, but primarily the Silent Hill movies for me, and that sort of format where there's an otherworldly element in the horror. It's not so much about the gore, it's more about the environment and the way that it plays on the mind.
Yeah, I think you raise a really good point there, to be honest with you, because so many of like horror video games that are out there really are rooted in that sort of psychological horror aspect as well. That seems to be the subgenre where a lot of horror is rooted, especially when it comes to video games. And they, like you say, have such a lot of parallels. And I love the Silent Hill video games. We've covered the first Silent Hill movie on this podcast previously. I think if you go all the way back, it's in the early days, but I think I reviewed it pretty favorably. And to be honest with you, it's one of my favorite sort of horror games to movie adaptations out there, and I think it's actually quite an underrated movie.
I would agree with you there. It's unfortunate because it's obviously very derivative, and anybody who looks at an adaptation is usually looking at it with a very critical eye. But for what it was and the way that they adapted the story and kind of melded like Silent Hill 1 and 2, mm-hmm. I just thought it was very clever, very creative. And I loved the use of the Silent Hill soundtrack from the games in the movie itself. And, you know, Akira Yamaoka, that's a whole different discussion that I could, you know, sidetrack myself on. But I love it.
Yeah, no, like I say, it was definitely something that I certainly enjoyed as well. And we are apparently getting a new Silent Hill movie at some point in the next few years as well. So hopefully that'll live up to the hype. But for me, I don't think it's any secret on the show, my favorite subgenre of horror is slasher movies. You know, I have just got a big old soft spot in my heart for some of those classic slasher villains. Michael Myers, you know, Jason, mm-hmm. Freddy Krueger, all of those. They are just, stick that on for me on a lovely, rainy, thundery Sunday afternoon, and I'll be happy for several hours.
Halloween Kills. I'm so hype.
I'm so gutted that I have to wait a full extra year for it, but I will I will be there opening night regardless.
Yes.
Okay, so we always do two horror questions. So the second horror question we have for you, this one's maybe requires a little bit more thinking. So who is your favorite horror villain that doesn't wear a mask?
Oh.
just to put you on the spot here.
See, that's the thing. It's like all of the key slasher, you know, they're the ones that you think of when you think of horror. They're wearing some sort of mask. They're a slasher villain. That's what a lot of early horror movies kind of came out of. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think of when I think of like my favorites. Okay. All right. So this is a little bit different. It wasn't the villain that wore the mask, and this is a little less on the line of horror, but bear with me on this line of thinking. Okay. You couldn't see them. So did you ever watch Bird Box?
Oh yes, I did. That's a great answer, actually.
I loved the fact that they didn't really show what it was, mm-hmm. and you couldn't really see them. I would have said the entity from Paranormal Activity, because I absolutely love that. And yes, it doesn't wear a mask, but they did kind of give away the entity from Paranormal Activity in a way that they didn't obviously explore in Bird Box. You never really truly see it.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a great response, and it's definitely something that wasn't really brought up that much, because like you say, when people are thinking of villains, they think of the physical sort of being, you know, like Michael Myers and all those sorts of other ones, and here you've got something that we've not shown on screen. Obviously, it doesn't wear a mask, so no, I think that's a great response. I went with a more sort of standard approach to it, and I went with Pinhead, personally.
Oh, fair.
Because Pinhead is just one of the most iconic characters, and I always think that he doesn't quite get the love he get like you know, Michael Myers gets. Of course, you could have had Freddy Krueger as well. Technically, doesn't wear a mask. But yeah, for me, Pinhead. I love the Hellraiser series as well. But awesome. So thank you very much to everyone on Twitter who responded to us on there. Those questions went out quite some time ago. Thank you to Jade for your answers as well. Don't forget, you can always respond to us. Like I say, we're putting those sorts of questions out almost every single day on our Twitter. So please do continue to respond to us. So are you ready to talk about today's film?
I've not absolutely.
Even, you know what, we're 10 minutes into this. I don't think I've actually told anyone what we're covering on today's show yet. So
you haven't actually mentioned it, you know?
I know, and
you...
that's usually the first thing that I do. I'll maybe have to go back and splice that in.
Also, sure.
So in today's episode, we are discussing Ma.
This is your spoiler alert.
Going to meet a boy.
No sex or booze.
Okay.
Woo!
Maggie came to party.
Let's get filthy.
What you sipping on? I got you talking crazy.
Excuse me, can you buy some booze for my friends and I?
Not interested.
Please?
Heel.
Woo! There's my girl.
This never happened, okay?
Thanks again for doing this, ma'am.
You guys want to party like rock stars? Follow me.
Let's get drunk!
The bar is open.
What do you think?
We don't know this chick.
It ain't much, but it's all you.
Cool basement.
You're free to do whatever you want down here, but nobody go upstairs.
This is so sick.
Welcome to Ma's.
What?
Love Ma?
It's 5 o'clock somewhere.
How did she get our numbers?
You know where the party is.
Those earrings are beautiful, Maggie. You got a sweet mama, huh?
Who are you with?
Just some kids from school.
You have a boyfriend.
Men are dogs.
There's something off about Ma.
Seriously?
She's homeless.
And her basement's pretty much the best drinking spot in town.
We can't go up there.
Shh.
What the hell?
Thanks for these earrings.
What happened last night?
You don't remember, do you?
Are you guys mad at me for something?
I don't want to hang out at Ma's anymore.
Don't make me drink alone. Don't make me drink alone.
Max, I want you to meet someone.
Nice to meet you, Maggie.
We went to high school together.
Why's my son?
He smelled just like your daddy.
Spending time at your house.
Hey, guys.
That bitch is crazy.
Probably something wrong with me. How does it feel to be on the outside looking in?
Let's get this party turned up.
Most fun I've had in a long time.
This film was released in 2019, directed by Tate Tyler, and stars Octavia Spencer, Diana Silvers, and Juliette Lewis. The IMDb plot was as follows. A lonely woman befriends a group of teenagers and decides to let them party at her house. Just when the kids think their luck couldn't get any better, things start happening that make them question the intention of their host. So, I'm just going to flat out ask you the question before we've even started going into the nitty-gritty. Would you recommend this movie?
Absolutely. 100%. Okay. Go ahead.
No, carry on.
So, what I thought was just really interesting is that she's not a villain. And even though she does some really messed up things, you see such a human side to her. And I think that as we kind of carry on the discussion, I'll get more opportunity to expound on that. But the reality is that Octavia Spencer's character is almost relatable because of the, you know, the past, the history, the flashbacks, the behavior that she displays is so human, and it's something that you could almost see, you know, in real life with somebody, say, that you know. And that, for me, is the most horrifying aspect of it, is it's real.
Yeah, definitely. Now, obviously, when we get into the sort of nitty-gritty in this movie, things are very over the top and very dramatic and, you know, turned all the way up to the 11, which isn't always true of real life, but we're discussing a horror movie, and that's what horror is all about, is being over dramatic and being, you know, all these extra things. But what you're saying there is absolutely right, in that Octavia Spencer's character, Su-An, is completely relatable in this movie to a point in terms of, you know, we all know someone who was humiliated for something at school. Again, it might not have been as extreme as for what she was humiliated for in school, and we'll probably get into it in a little bit more detail as well as the discussion goes on. But we all know someone who had a really hard time at school through being bullied or picked on or anything like that. And we know how much that can actually have a negative effect on someone moving forward in their life as well.
Mm-hmm. It's tough because no matter where you go, whether you're a child or you're an adult, it affects everyone around you. And then, you know, you can see it's almost kind of like a conversation or a discourse on how the ripple effect can be so far reaching.
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, this they obviously, I mean, we can just get right into it because we often like to bounce around on this show anyway, in the movies. We don't have to go through things chronologically. So for those who haven't seen the movie yet, they sort of trick Su-An as a young character. We get these sort of several flashback scenes where they trick her into performing, we'll just say, a sex act on someone who she thought was someone else.
Yep.
And they all make fun of her and, you know, they humiliate her and things like that. And she obviously carries that further on into her adult life and into her sort of middle age life as well. We're never actually told how old any of these sorts of adults in this film are. We know the kids in the film are is it 16, I believe they are in the film?
Roughly, I would say.
So,
yeah.
You know, we would probably put the parents in and around the sort of 40s in terms of maybe age range. I think that would be a relatively sort of safe place to put them. So she's obviously carried this with her for a long, long time. And, you know, some 20 odd years later, possibly, this is still affecting her day-to-day life. You know, it's affecting her work life. It's affecting the relationships she's able to have with others. It's affected her own relationship she's had with her own daughter as well. So you're absolutely right in terms of these things that to some people might not seem like such a big deal, whilst you're at school especially, can have such massive ripple effects going on into someone's further life.
Absolutely. And when you see just how undone she becomes, which is, you know, very much stems from the trauma. I mean, you look at where she is in life too. I mean, she didn't get anywhere. She's working at a veterinary, you know, like an animal clinic.
Yeah.
And so she never left the town. She never really did anything with herself. Whereas, you know, the other people, her peers, you know, the main character, Maggie, her mother, she ended up going to California, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy that she liked, that she thought she was performing this act with in the closet at school, I mean, he owns a business, you yeah. know. Well, Mercedes is Mercedes, though.
Yeah, I'm more of a Porsche guy as well.
I did really have to chuckle at that line, you know.
Yeah. No, definitely. Okay, one of the things, and it's possibly my biggest positive about this movie, let's talk about Octavia Spencer, because I think she is phenomenal in this movie.
Absolutely. For me, like, when I don't know if you got to watch any of the interviews and whatnot, when she was originally asked about it, she was asked, like, hey, I've got this idea. You know, do you want to star in this movie? And she, the first thing that came out of her mouth was, do I die in the first 15 minutes? But I mean, she was elated when, you know, she found out that she was actually going to be the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take a look at, like, a number of the other movies that she's done, she's never really in that role. She's always been a much, you know, in a lot more family friendly movies, I guess, where, you know, she's not taken such a dark role. And I think that this for her was a really great opportunity to kind of like spread her wings.
Yeah, definitely. It was a really good chance for her to just sort of show her range as well. Like you say, we've obviously seen her in a number of things up to this point as well. And she's been great in pretty much everything she's been in. She's obviously worked with the director before, Tate Tyler. I believe they worked together on The Help, I think. Don't quote me on that. I might be getting that slightly wrong. So they know each other well from previous working relationships before. The role itself was originally supposed to be a white woman. And then Tate Tyler, when he read the script, was like, actually, you know, I think I've got the perfect person for this. And then offered it to Octavia Spencer. But you're absolutely right, you know. And I think her performance here, it's very Kathy Bates Misery-esque. If you sort of get this sort, because there are certain references from this movie to Misery as well. Things like, you know, when the kids break into her house and they move the cat ornaments, you know, and she notices it, and that's sort of like a little callback. But I do get very sort of Annie Wilkes vibes off of her here. And I think she plays it really well. And I think that's such a difficult sort of role to try and emulate, because Kathy Bates in that movie is utterly amazing. It's one of the few movies that I think I gave a perfect score to. And I think she does a really, really good job here as well. And Octavia Spencer herself is just such a likable person as well. She's got that sort of natural charm and charisma that you just can't help but root for her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When she was kind of like looking at the, I think she was looking at the script at the time, and she was thinking to herself, like, okay, how am I going to portray Sue Ann? You know, she more or less boiled it down, you know, to this revenge tale where, you know, she has this character that's stuck on her rejection and then, you know, carries the trauma that stems from it. And then, you know, she apparently snapped into this character so well, like just on set, she was just absolutely killed it to the point where, you know, like she literally scared other people on set.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, normally when you hear those sorts of stories as well, you know, you hear about certain actors who are a bit more method, you know, and like to stay in character between shots and everything. And when you get those sorts of big examples, they almost always work. Now, obviously, you're always going to get, you know, some some two-bit actor who thinks that they're, you know, who thinks they're Kathy Bates, or who thinks that they're, you know, Kenneth Branagh or anything like that, and they're just like, oh, I must remain in character between shots, and they're absolutely terrible. You're always going to get that. But I think here, Octavia Spencer at this point, everyone already knew how great an actress she already was. So I think, you know, if she decides, you know, I'm going to try and stay in character, you know, whether that's making people on set feel unnerved or not, you've just got to go with that flow, because she is someone who, you know, knows what she's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently so. I mean, it was the first real role that introduced me to Octavia Spencer. So for me, I was left feeling very impressed.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, it was the exact same for me. This was also the first time I had ever seen Octavia Spencer in anything. I have since gone on to watch some of our other movies. She is great in, pretty much everything that I've seen her in. But watching her in this definitely made me look at movies she'd done and think, I definitely want to watch that. It's got Octavia Spencer in it.
Yeah, to be able to make a name for yourself in a movie where you're playing the villain like that, to the point where people actually want to go back and watch your other films. I mean, obviously you did something right.
Yeah, definitely. I think the thing is, when it comes to horror as well, is that the villain is more often than not, the most important character in a horror movie, you know. Now obviously that does vary in certain horror movies where, you know, maybe the villain doesn't have any dialogue or anything like that, but I think in this type of scenario where the film is really centered around, you know, the character of Sue Ann, so I imagine she probably had a lot of fun with this role as well, because you often hear from like stage actors as well, especially the sort of ones who do things like pantomime and stuff like that, that playing the villain is so much more fun than playing the hero, because you get to be sort of like fake nasty to people, and, you know, you just get to have a bit of fun with it. And you often hear about, you know, things like performance art, when you watch things like professional wrestling and things like that, you always hear that the heels or the villains are always that much more fun to play.
Mm-hmm. So, and when you're watching a movie, this extends to outside of horror too, but I mean, when you have a protagonist, you already have the perspective of the movie itself. The defining aspect of the plot is already aligned with that of the protagonist. So there's something already substantiated there in the protagonist's role. And then when you have this villain, the villain has to do something much more to be able to make a profound mark. And I mean, if the viewership typically is going to identify with the protagonist by virtue of the protagonist's role and the perspective of the story, then for me to walk away relating and almost cheering for Su-Ann, I mean, absolutely killed it. Just, I can't say enough about it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Okay, so you've mentioned protagonists there. So let's talk about the protagonists of this film a little bit. How do you feel about the sort of protagonists in this film? Do you relate to them? Do you like what the sort of direction they took it in with some of the decisions they made? What's your sort of overall feeling about our sort of main group of teenagers here?
Well, I thought Maggie was interesting in that they set, you know, like right out the gate, you know, you've got this pan of them, her and her mother in the vehicle, and they're driving back, you know, home, so to speak. They're moving back to the town that Erica came from. So when you're introduced to the two of them, you kind of see this charming interaction between the mother and the daughter, which I feel is sustained throughout, but is unfortunately missed a little bit because of the deleted scenes. But I feel that between the two of them, it's very authentic. But the moment that you start putting Maggie in with the rest of the group of popular kids at school, I kind of got the feeling that she was like the homeschooler of the group. You know, she didn't really seem to fit in, despite the fact that she, you know, was completely okay with any of the activities that they were in. And, you know, she was on board with just about everything. She, you know, she was definitely a prominent character. There was something about her that just didn't seem like she was part of the group to me. I don't know if you got that impression, but she just seemed to stand out.
What I was sort of waiting on, and I was always sort of constantly expecting it, is I was waiting for the prank, you know, because so often in a movie where you've got like a new kid or someone who's deemed unpopular at school, and then they're sort of befriended by these more popular kids. And again, this is obviously something that's dealt with in this movie with in terms of the flashbacks as well, is I was waiting for that to happen to Maggie.
That's exactly what I was looking at too, because when they were kind of hinting about the backstory of Su-Ann, I was expecting, oh god, you know, they're going to repeat this. Maggie's going to be the next Su-Ann. And I was kind of thinking they might take it in a different way, where Maggie, you know, kind of aligns herself and finds herself a home, you know, under Su-Ann's wing and becomes the next Su-Ann.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, I mean, that's definitely a direction they could have taken it in as well. And it certainly wouldn't have been completely outrageous for them to take it in that direction. And it's sort of where I thought things were going to go. And I wasn't really sure, especially early on, you know, that scene where they sort of make her go out and ask the adults if they can buy her alcohol, if they can buy alcohol for them. And I really thought, okay, here's where it's going to happen. And then later when, you know, they're caught all drinking at the rock piles, I thought, okay, here's where it's going to happen. And they do give like a few different sort of almost red herrings about, you know, sort of like the group's intentions. And then obviously as the film goes on, you realize there is no ulterior motive here in the group. I have to say, out of the group, Maggie's probably the only one that I liked. I don't know if liked's really the best word to describe. None of the group do anything particularly egregious or particularly offensive. You know, sometimes when you get these kind of movies, especially when it's involving, you know, sort of teenagers, some of the teenagers either just make really ridiculous decisions, and don't get me wrong, these teenagers make some relatively poor decisions as well, or they just do things that you think, that's just outrageous and completely sort of disconnect you from the characters. And I don't necessarily feel that any of the teenagers did that here as well, but I just feel like we didn't get a lot of backstory for any of them. There's no real overarching character arc for most of them. And so I just feel like I didn't really connect with a lot of them very well.
Yeah, I did feel that the majority of them were fairly two-dimensional. You know, you have the initial introduction, and then they kind of stay flat the entire way through. There's no real development or cultivation of the characters. I mean, I think the one that gets, you know, closest to that obviously is Andy. Mm-hmm. I mean, Andy kind of, he kind of crushes on her a little bit straight out the gate, but I mean, you see him where he goes from crushing to, okay, they're a thing, and to starting to hide and lie about what he's doing, where he, you know, he keeps it from Maggie and goes to the party at Ma's after she very, you know, clearly said, look, I'm not really comfortable with this. I don't want us hanging around anymore. And he even agrees.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I felt like, you know, that's about as deep as they get with the other characters.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, throughout the entire film, I always sort of had the feeling that there was something a little bit disingenuous about Andy, specifically him as well, something that I maybe didn't necessarily get off the rest, especially once I realised, you know what, I don't think they're really going to be that sort of prankster on Maggie. But throughout the film, I always felt that there was something, maybe just, I don't know if it was just something a little bit off, I don't know, it was just something in my gut that was telling me. And obviously we get that, we'll talk about it when we're talking about the finale and the sort of bizarreness that happens, excuse me, in those sorts of final scenes. But I did always feel like there was a little bit of disingenuous about him. And you're absolutely right, you know, about sort of hiding things, going to the party when Maggie had asked him not to, and very legitimately asked him not to as well. Like, it's not even as if, you know, he could have turned around and been like, oh, you're just being crazy, you're overreacting. She had very legitimate reasons as well for asking him, please, can we not go here anymore?
And I believe that was actually right after when, I think it was Stephanie who had the party, and, you know, they ended up doing shots. Ma kind of came in, Sue Ann was like, okay, shots, everybody. And there was the one shot that was, you know, different colored.
Yeah.
And she was very adamant that Maggie have this shot. And so, you know, what ends up happening? Okay, she gets peer pressured into it. She does. And then she gets sloppy. Mm-hmm. And then at that point in time, she can't remember what she did the night before, and her mother's earrings are missing, which is also another deleted scene. You never see her get it from her mother, but it was a very sweet moment.
No, you're completely right. And can I just say that I'm the person at the party who tries to force everyone to drink shots. Whenever I'm at the bar and the people come around and are like, oh, do you want any shots? I usually buy like the whole tray. So apologies to my friends for that, because I am a terrible influence when it comes to drinking shots. But Sambuca's my go-to shot anyway, so but no, you're absolutely right about everything that you've just said there. Okay, so we'll keep on talking about some of the things that we like here. We'll get into maybe some of the more specifics about Ma in just a moment. I want to talk about some of the death scenes that we get here, because I mean, this movie is an hour and 40 minutes long, and we only really get 3 deaths in the entire film, one of which is off screen as well. But I want to talk about specifically right now the death of Mercedes, because this to me was one of the funniest things I've seen in the longest time.
I don't know how they made that body, like, it had to have been a fake, obviously. I don't know how they did that and then had it roll like that and look so real. But I mean, you've got, you know, Sue Ann, she's pissed off at Mercedes because she felt the connection with Erica. She goes speeding down with her truck down the highway where Mercedes is, you know, in her jogging outfit, and she's going for a jog. And what does Ma do? She guns it and just completely runs her down.
Yeah, and then of course she has like this sort of quirky one-liner at the end where she's like, oh, I'll run you down, bitch, or something along those lines.
Something like that, yeah.
And, honestly, and then what topped it off for me was that she turned on the radio in September by Earth, Wind, and Fire started playing, and it was just hilarious. I absolutely was side-splitting with laughter at this point.
There were some comedic elements that I do really feel they weren't just comic relief. They were actually comedic, like one-liners that were put in there as the punchline that actually, it just delivered. It was so, and I don't know. It just really kind of like, sent home just, you know, how much you want to relate to Sue Ann and how much you want to like her, because she's got charisma. She's got, you know, personality. She's relatable in a lot of ways, especially when it comes, like I said, you know, to the trauma, for instance.
Yeah, and of course, at this point as well, you know, she's obviously, just before this happens, she sort of feels like potentially her world is starting to crumble around her. Her game is up virtually. It's starting, like, she's beginning to be discovered, and so this is obviously her reaction to that, you know. And we've all been in a situation where, you know, something happens and you're furious or whatever, and you just want to do something, obviously do something, but obviously for 99% of us, we resist those urges, and you know, we just maybe say a few swear words and that'll be done with it. But obviously Mark kind of takes it to the extreme at this point and absolutely guns Mo's Mercedes down. And again, I completely agree with you that the actual death itself looked fantastic.
Wait, we're not supposed to run over people we like with our car?
I'm afraid not. That is kind of frowned upon.
Well, oh dear. Don't Ian, worry. You could have told me this before we started, man.
Okay, don't worry. I'll help you hide the body. It's fine.
Oh, thanks. Okay, awesome.
So we do get two other death scenes, one of which we'll leave just now because it's one of our main cast. But we've also got the death of Ben, who is Andy's father, and is the person who was sort of one of the masterminds behind the whole humiliation of Su-An when she was at school. We get this almost sort of sweet moment before it happens where she thinks that he's sort of asking her out on a date.
Mm-hmm.
And when, obviously, we'll get into it, but when it's sort of revealed that that's not the case at all, I kind of just feel bad for her.
Right. I mean, he totally led her on the whole way. He obviously knew, and he even admits this in a scene later on when he threatens her at the I think it was bar or the restaurant where, you know, he grabs himself a drink and then, you know, gets pissed at her for associating with Andy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he knows he's not giving her the time of day. He's talking her along. She obviously doesn't have, she's timid. She doesn't have a lot of self-confidence. She's not really extroverted or outgoing by any stretch. And, you know, he sits next to her, grabs her a drink, and, you know, she says, "I like your hair." And he says, "Oh, I like yours too." Obviously, to her, that meant a lot more. And he just continues that charade.
Yeah, because as well, like you say, she's obviously someone who doesn't have a lot of self-confidence, which will stem from the experiences she had from school as well. But she also strikes me as a person who doesn't actually have that many personal interactions with people other than in passing. She obviously speaks to a lot of people at her workplace, but always in a sort of more professional environment. And, you know, we never really get to see or know if, you know, she has any sort of friends that she's developed since she left high school. I think we're obviously led to believe that she's somewhat of a loner, especially since her ex-husband was no longer in the picture, although we don't really get too many details into what happened there. She's obviously got her own daughter, which I think is something that we'll also get into in just a little bit as well. But, you know, so you're absolutely right. I feel like when she would receive a compliment, even just as simple as, "Oh, I like your hair," which is a perfectly acceptable thing for anyone to say to anyone, mm-hmm. in everyday life, that will mean a whole lot more to her. And especially coming from someone who she used to idolize, I don't know if we would still say that she does, but someone who she sort of had up on a pedestal at one point.
Right, yeah, she definitely had a soft spot for Ben.
Definitely. Okay, so one thing I want to talk about is, we've sort of touched on these already, but I want to talk about the sort of themes that are dealt with in this movie in terms of bullying, and in terms of like how that can impact upon people, but they're like mental health as well, and maybe how well or not so well, if that's your opinion on how this movie sort of dealt with that. This incident that happened to Su-An was terrible.
Yeah, it absolutely was. She was left in a scenario full of humiliation. I mean, she was goaded into a sex act with somebody that she thought that she would be willing to have this sort of first experience with. And then to find out that it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even Ben at the end of it. It was all part of this, you know, class-wide prank where she did something that she would not have consented to. I mean, absolutely horrible. And then everybody was there waiting for her when they got out, you know, when she got out of the closet, and literally laughed at her.
Yeah, definitely. So that's definitely something that's going to stick with any human being for the rest of their life. You know, they're always going to have to deal with that sort of humiliation, and, you know, just however that makes you feel, I can't obviously relate on a personal level to how that would make someone feel, but I can only imagine. But that would stick with someone for life, quite frankly. And I think I think Octavia Spencer, this is the other sort of string to the bow of how well I think she performs this role, because for a large part of this movie, in fact, probably for about 90% of this movie, she's portraying this sort of facade of everything is cool, you know, I'm just trying to be this nice, helpful lady. She's trying to, you know, give these kids somewhere nice to drink and somewhere safe to drink, and, you know, just generally be this sort of likable person. And I feel like for a lot of people with mental health as well, that's what a lot of it is putting on a face for everyone you meet in your day-to-day life to say to them, I'm okay.
I do think that in many regards, there is the propensity for us as we're, you know, in the midst of whether it's anxiety, depression, whatever mental anguish or mental health issues that we may be struggling with, for us to want to kind of hide behind the mask and put on a smile, because it's difficult for people to, you know, to open up about that. And that much I do understand. For me, when I watched this, I guess I got more of the impression that for her, she just wanted to be liked. She was always the one where, you know, she was on the outside looking in, and she even talks about that to Erica when they kind of have their falling out at the liquor store, for instance. And so in this case, when she's first introduced and she finally is like, oh, fine, you know, takes the money from Maggie and goes and buys these teenagers the alcohol, she's the cool one. Finally, she's on the pedestal. She's the one getting recognition and being liked. And even though it's as, you know, skin deep as just, you know, people giving you money so that way they can get the booze, you're just the object, the vehicle for their booze. You know, she decides to put herself in there because she wants to sustain this. She never got that sort of attention. She never got that sort of validation. And this is obviously after her husband has already left her. So she's already got a emptiness that is being compounded with probably a blow to her self-worth, not really going anywhere in life, not particularly liked at her job either. And then there are these kids that suddenly, oh, you know, she's the cool one. And then you see where it turns sinister. And I think that is, for me, where she finally starts to show, okay, this is due to a lack of substance within herself, a lack of stability, a lack of self-worth. She's looking for other people to validate her. She hasn't yet begun to accept herself for who she is and come to terms with the trauma that she's experienced.
Yeah. One of the things as well is the irony of it all. She is looking for that sort of acceptance from people. If she had just maintained the sort of relationship she was having with these kids in the beginning, they were accepting her, and they were going to be very accepting of her, and she would have probably made friends for a long time. Obviously, there's a big age gap here between Ma and these kids, but, you know, in the beginning, the relationship seems like a pretty genuine one as well. And I think if she had just maintained that, she probably would have gotten some of that acceptance that she was craving so much. One of the other things I want to ask you is, do you think that this was Ma's plan all along? Or is this something that sort of developed over time?
I think that it was something that developed. If you watch it and you see the way that she starts out very relatable, I don't think it's just, you know, her showing a sinister side with this really grandiose plot of like hooking these kids and then forcing them to be her friends, so much as it was when they first, you know, when they started to pull away or started to become less available, that's when she started getting scared. And that's when she started getting more erratic. That was when she started, you know, putting these guilt trips on them and doing things that are, you know, definitely crossing the line of, you know, social discourse to ensure that she had some sort of access, almost like a druggie needing a fix for their attention and validation that she's finally getting.
Yeah, and of course as well, like, we're speaking about her sort of crossing those lines. You know, she does things like lie to them about having cancer when it looks as if they're finally sort of pulling away from her as well. So, you know, she definitely does some very questionable moral things in order to try and keep these kids around. One of the things I will say that makes me think, maybe not necessarily that she had this sort of sinister of a plot, but that maybe she had something in the back of her mind, was in that opening scene where the kids ask her to go and buy booze for them for the first time. She initially refuses them, and then when she sees the name on the truck or on the van, that's when she agrees to help them. So in my mind, I'm thinking maybe not necessarily that, you know, she plans on having the big finale that we get, but maybe some sort of revenge, or even if it's something as innocent as sort of saying, well, I couldn't be friends with your dad, but maybe I can be friends with you.
I guess there could be a case then, especially given the story arc with her quote-unquote sick daughter. I think that that was all a measure of control. She lost her husband, she lost, you know, all of her friends, she didn't go anywhere in life, so she's keeping her daughter under the needle, so to speak, just so that way there's somebody in her life who quote-unquote needs her. So there could be a case where she saw Hawkins, and she even mentions, oh, you're Hawkins' boy.
Yeah.
So maybe there is something there where she was like, I want in with these kids.
Yeah. And like I say, I maybe don't think that the finale that we're about to talk about was necessarily her plan from the beginning. And I agree with you that perhaps that was developed over time, especially as they sort of started to pull away from her as well. Let's talk about this big finale then, because we've sort of alluded to it on several occasions. This film is paced... It's paced to me maybe a little bit bizarrely, because it's kind of a slow burn for most of it, and then this finale is just batshit crazy.
Yeah, it is. It goes from 0 to 100 real quick.
I mean, that is. I'm looking at my notes just now, and my bullet point for this is seems to go from 0 to 100 very quickly. So, great minds absolutely think alike here. Okay. How do you feel about this finale and this whole sort of different styles of punishment she has for the group?
Well, I mean, there was two deaths that resulted from the finale that I thought was interesting. But the first one, I mean, she's essentially drugged all of them. She's got them kept in her basement. Most of them are tied up in some way, shape, or form, even so much as to go and paint Darrell's face white, because apparently there's only room enough for one in every friend group. Yeah. I mean, she's absolutely insane.
Yeah.
So I definitely felt that, like, this was her final, like, she's definitely broken here. The sanity is gone, and she's doing anything that she can to maintain control as everybody's kind of like slipping like sand through her fingers.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Her world has completely fallen around her. The jig is up, you know, and I feel like at this point it's one of those cases where she's like, well, if I can't be your friend as well, then no one can be your friends as well. Like, and maybe in her head it was some sort of, well, now we can almost be together sort of forever in a friendship group sort of thing, you know. And like you say, she's completely broken, so any hopes of logical thought from her are completely gone, like you say, with, you know, saying to Darrell, there's only room for one of us here in this friendship group. And, you know, yeah, that's, she's completely lost any semblance of sanity at this point. We do obviously, I can't remember if we even mentioned how Ben died. She obviously has Ben tied up to her bed, and this really sort of awkward scene where she threatens to cut off his genitalia, which I'm sure brought a tear to the eye of most men who were watching.
Well, I didn't really want to see that much of male genitalia in a movie, but no, there we are.
and then she eventually just sort of slits his wrists and leaves him there. And then we'll go back to him in just a second as well. And then, aside from painting Durell white, you know, she sews Haley's mouth closed. She puts a hot iron onto Chad's skin, because yep. She's obviously alluded to earlier that she thinks, you know, he's obviously the pretty boy of the group, so she's obviously trying to deform him. Haley's obviously like the chatty gossip, so she sews his mouth shut. And then Andy, and we get this really bizarre scene where Andy proclaims his love for her.
So I think, because he wakes up, he's looking at Maggie, and Maggie's kind of subtly gesturing both with their eyes and with, you know, short nods. Mm-hmm. I think Andy was just trying to get a leg up so that way he might be able to have an avenue to help the others. But he does. He gets up. I mean, there's a full, like, snog session going on there for a moment.
Yeah, I have to say, I did kind of feel a little bit uncomfortable at this point.
Yep.
And I definitely had a full what the fuck moment when when that happened, because I certainly didn't see that coming.
Well, the interesting thing about this too, and this is a bit of a lesser character, the girl who was the pastor's child, the one who always pretended to sleep so she could go to parties, you know, but not get drunk.
Ashley.
Yep, she was there. But you never see her after she gets clubbed with the same iron that she burns Chaz's chest with.
Yeah,
my assumption at that point is that when the house burns down, she goes with it, because she's not with the rest of the group afterward. Yeah, at least I don't think so.
That's something that I hadn't really picked up on. So you raise a really interesting point. It would be interesting. I would need to go back and sort of study those scenes very, very carefully. But she is definitely never mentioned again as well, and we don't really we don't get any other sightings of her. I wonder if that's maybe just a continuity error in the film, or if we're just led to believe that they kind of forgot to help her escape.
she wasn't really that important, you know. I'm sure.
But I did find it quite amusing, her whole sort of shtick of she pretends to be passed out so that she doesn't actually have to drink, and then technically she's not broken her dad's rules. I thought that was quite a nice little touch there. And then obviously, so the house is then set on fire. Ma gets trapped in the house, and then she seems to accept her fate, and she goes and lies down in the bed with dead Ben. And obviously, you know, this is maybe her way of sort of being, in my opinion anyway, of sort of being, you know, you're mine now. I at least get to sort of go out with the person who I idolized at one point.
Yeah, there is definitely that obsession on behalf of Sue Ann. So, just to the point where she would rather that nobody could have him, and not even himself. You know, she killed him, and she'd rather have him in death for the brief moment. And even before the house was burning to that degree, I mean, she tries to restrain her daughter, who also tries to escape with the other children. Mm-hmm. Maggie plants a long kitchen knife in her back.
Yeah.
So I mean, she's bleeding out. And what does she do? She doesn't try to escape. She walks up to the top floor of her burning house to lie in bed with a dead person.
Yeah, and it just obviously goes to show you know, just how broken she is at this point as well. She actually walks through flames to get there as well. Like, you get this really cool scene of her sort of going up the stairs, and the flames are just sort of lapping around her as well, and she's just sort of walking through the fire, which I kind of liked. I thought that was a really just sort of cool visual.
It kind of gave me that Halloween. It was 2018, I think, or was it 2018.
Yeah. Right, he's in the basement at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Where Michael's there, he's trapped, and he's just looking up, and the flames are just kind of like bathing him, so to speak. It gave me that same sort of vibe with regards to the cinematography.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, you're right, because I think there's always something quite visually striking as well when someone who is supposedly burning or walking through fire, and they appear unaffected.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One of the last things, before we maybe move on to some of the things that I maybe didn't like or some of the negatives I had around this movie. I love the soundtrack to this film, you know. We've already sort of talked about September by Earth, Wind and Fire was played. We also got the Safety Dance in this film, and we got Funky Town as well. And I've probably mentioned this on the show before, but I'm a bartender. I bartend at a retro 80s venue, so these are absolutely the kind of songs that I hear every night when I'm bartending. So it just kind of hit a note for me.
Well, I thought it was actually just really, it was a cool, like, callback to Sue Ann's generation. This was obviously a movie, even though she was the antagonist, where the majority of the plot does center and evolve around Sue Ann. So it was just really cool to see, you know, how these ragers that she's throwing, you know, a lot of the music is, you know, music of that period.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so is there anything else in terms of positives about this movie that you want to quickly mention that we've maybe not mentioned
yet? I honestly thought it was both humorous but also fantastic that Tate Taylor played Officer Granger.
Oh, yes, actually, I forgot to mention that. That was something I literally found out about half an hour before we came on air when I was trying to look up some trivia.
I thought it was fantastic. Like, I loved his character, and I just found it quite amusing that he's, you know, a cop that, you know, he's likable from the beginning, where there's the scene at the pit with the kids. They obviously get the anonymous call because, you know, Ben, who has a tracking device on his, you know, Andy's van, first and foremost, but also gets a call from Sue Ann to say that, hey, you know, your kids are drinking at the rock pile. So, you know, Granger shows up and everybody's losing their mind because, you know, they're underage. And he comes out and says, you know, essentially, you know, Andy, I knew your dad. Your dad's a dick. So I'm going to come back in 10 minutes and you're going to clear all this up. Do you understand? And they all get off scot-free. And then later on, in one of the deleted scenes, actually, before the time that he shows up at the front door in the core movie, he actually showed up a time before that while there were people there during the middle of a party, and there were cars along the side of the road and stuff like that. That kind of was what lit his suspicion and provides a little bit more context to his a little more forward interaction where eventually, you know, he gets shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you're right. And it definitely seems, though, that these deleted scenes that we've sort of missed out from the core movie definitely would have added maybe just that little bit more depth and context to the film that I think it maybe was needing. I think without those sort of deleted scenes, certain aspects of the film can sometimes maybe feel, I don't really know what the word, maybe not incomplete, but maybe just lacking a little bit of context.
It could have, you know, substantiated or provided a little more depth, I feel, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm going to get into some of the things, maybe not necessarily negatives about the film, but some of the things I felt maybe weren't quite done as well. And that's the sort of, one of the things that I want to sort of talk about is we get these flashbacks of what happened to Sue Ann at school. And then we obviously have her in the present day. I maybe would have quite liked to have seen something in the middle, maybe some flashbacks to how that had affected her relationship with her husband, or how it affected their relationship with her daughter in the early days, or when she found out that her daughter was sick or anything like that. And I felt like we kind of needed that just to give a little bit extra context and backstory.
Obviously, there was some sort of significance with her husband. My assumption based upon the movie is that the husband left because she was crazy, but that's left to assumption. Or, for instance, like you said, the daughter's quote-unquote sickness. Well, it would have been really nice if we had had some sort of hint or some sort of allusion to those events, what the impact was or what really had happened, because obviously they were significant in present day but not really explored.
Yeah, no, definitely, I completely agree with that. And look, at the end of the day, it's not like a major thing, and when it comes to, you know, necessarily my enjoyment for this film, because I did enjoy this film. So this is just me probably a little bit nitpicky at this point. But you know, that's what we're here to do. We're here to sort of nitpick about movies and about things. The other thing I would say, there was a couple of little jump scares in the movie that I didn't really feel were particularly necessary. That it's not really that kind of movie, so I didn't really feel having a couple of, albeit small, like they're not big major points, but having those couple of jump scares in there really weren't necessary. Look, I'm not really one for massive jump scares. Don't get me wrong, in certain movies, they are absolutely necessary. I know you mentioned, you know, like Paranormal Activity earlier, which is a movie that is quite reliant on jump scares. Excuse me. And that's something, but that's something that they do that really well. And, you know, it really fits in with the theme of what they're going for in that movie. And especially when, you know, you look at that movie and the sort of budget they was working with and that. And I just don't really think they're needed here. But I think that's maybe more just personal preference rather than necessarily a criticism of the movie.
I don't think that it was, you know, at all beneficial to the movie. Mm. Because the jump scares kind of came off with cheek. It was just like, oh, that was cheesy, why did you do that, you know? That was kind of the impression that I got. They were minor, but like you said, for instance, we're like with Paranormal Activity, okay, this makes a lot more sense because you're spending a lot of time building the atmosphere and the suspense, a lot of camera pans that hang just a little bit too long, building that sense of anxiety to the point where the viewer is, okay, you know, holding their breath, and then all of a sudden, bam, and then you have that flash in the pan and everybody jumps, you know, and that makes a lot more sense within the context of the way that it's presented. Whereas with this, it just seemed a little out of place.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And like I say, I don't really think it was necessary. I think they were building the tension quite well, and especially Octavia Spencer in terms of her acting performance as well. You know, and as the movie goes on, you do slowly start to see her sort of character unravel, and you do feel anxious about that. And let's not forget, literally the first sort of suspicious thing she does is she pulls a gun out on Chad. It's mm-hmm. literally the first thing that she does when they arrive at her house.
And then she tries to pan it off or pass it off as like a joke, like, oh, it don't even work. Like, okay, all right, you're backpedaling. Yeah. Now. That was a little weird.
It was a little weird, but again, it just sort of, for me, I kind of added to her charm as well, because she was, again, it was something that she was clearly very charismatic. It proved that she was very charismatic as well. But as the movie went on, I felt that she really sort of played that sort of slowly and slowly becoming more and more unhinged. And you see it in various times, you know. And you sort of see it, you know, in those scenes where she's at her workplace and her boss is kind of losing her patience with her because she's spending more and more time on her phone, you know, is doing some sleuthing and trying to look up these kids' social medias, and she's not actually doing her job. And I think that worked quite well in parallel.
I agree that those worked for sure. But I think the biggest struggle for me was trying to place the relevance. And it wasn't really until you see her pull the diazepam, I think it was, from the medicine chest, where you realize, okay, so this is where she's getting the drugs. It almost felt to me like it was just kind of stuck in there for some way for her to get drugs that she would then use on the kids, you know, later on in the story. I found that those were probably the most dry segments, but that's me being nitpicky for you.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you're definitely right. I mean, I feel like they were definitely in there to help as a plot device for the reason why she has access to these sorts of drugs and things like that. So it definitely can be interpreted that way. Okay, so before we move on to the trivia, is there anything else at all that you want to talk about this movie?
I really, really do suggest that anybody who like picks it up, you pick up the version with the alternate ending, because it also has the deleted scenes and all that. There's actually a fair bit of the development, especially between Maggie and Erica, that occurs that is completely left off camera, including Maggie saying, hey, you know, I want to talk to Dad. And you never hear this or see this. Dad's not even a part of the picture, apart from, oh, we got divorced. And it falls into the same trappings at that point as, okay, well, obviously, Sue Ann had a husband. He's not part of the picture either. And then that's it. You know, I think that there's a lot of it that could have been fleshed out or given context and substantiated in the middle ground, so to speak, mm-hmm. that just got chopped.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. It's something, like I say, we've obviously touched on a couple of times before. I feel that there is more to the story here that should have been present, or should have just been given that sort of backstory and maybe fleshed out a little bit more. So if I was going to have a major criticism of this film, that would probably be it. But I think overall, it doesn't really affect my overall enjoyment of the movie. But it kind of means that I feel like if you're watching this movie with a critical eye like we are, then you're going to notice that there's maybe parts missing. Whereas I feel like if you're just sort of throwing this movie on, you're not, maybe not, I'm not saying not necessarily paying attention to it, but you know what, like sometimes when you're just sitting at home and you're like, oh, let's just watch a movie, let's just throw this on, and you just have a blast with it. And I feel like this is maybe the perfect kind of movie to do that with.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so let's move on and let's talk about some trivia.
Movie trivia.
So when I did my research, there was a shocking lack of trivia about this movie. So this is going to be a pretty short segment. This movie had a budget of $5 million and grossed in its initial run $61.1 million approximately. So a fair financial success. It did really well at the box office.
I'm surprised in the fact that Rotten Tomatoes threw Rotten Tomatoes at it.
Yeah, we'll get onto that when we get into our ratings, but the critics were not particularly kind to this film, but I believe it made around $20 million in its opening weekend. So I think for any movie to make four times its budget in its opening weekend, it can be deemed a pretty successful financially.
I agree. I mean, when I was first kind of introduced to the movie through, well, we went to watch Brightburn in theaters. I never go to the theater, but a couple friends of mine and Lorna, we went to see Brightburn, and when they had the opening ads, the Ma was one of them, and I was like, oh, that looks interesting, okay, cool. And so we ended up picking it up. It was like one of the first Blu-rays I got after I got a PS4, because I didn't have a Blu-ray player. But
definitely the trailer for this movie I think was quite effective as well. It obviously got people's sort of interest peaked as well, so yeah, it definitely did well at the box office. The cast of this movie actually contains two Oscar winners in this movie, and one of them is one that you might not know. So obviously Octavia Spencer has won an Oscar. She won Best Supporting Actress for her role in The Help. Alison Janney, who plays Dr. Brooks, who is the veterinarian in this movie, she is also an Oscar winner, and she won Best Supporting Actress in I, Tonya. And then you've also got Juliette Lewis, who plays Erica in this movie, and she was nominated for the exact same reward, Best Supporting Actress, in 1991 for her role in Cape Fear. So a pretty reputable cast in this, and we've not even talked about Juliette Lewis in this movie.
No, actually, we didn't really touch on her at all. I had no idea Alison Janney was a winner as well, though. That's actually really cool.
Yeah, and just to show, I mean, because we're talking about the budget, $5 million in 2019, even for a Blumhouse horror movie, and we know Blumhouse do sort of lower budget horror movies, but $5 million is not a lot of money when it comes to making a horror movie. So no. I feel like to get, two Oscar winners and an Oscar nominee, and for one of the major awards as well, was pretty good going.
Yeah, I thought that the cast was actually really good. I didn't ever feel like the delivery of the story or any of the scenes particularly lacked in skills on behalf of the actors. So the fact that they were able to hire those actors on such a low budget and be able to provide the quality of content, that's impressive.
Yeah, definitely. And finally, before we move on, the original script for this movie, we obviously have talked about how we maybe could have done with getting a little bit more backstory. The original script for this movie had absolutely no backstory for Ma and had no flashback scenes.
Oh.
I think they absolutely made the right choice to add them in.
100%, because I think that a lot of it really becomes relatable when you see her start to unravel. The part where my heart kind of broke for Sue Ann was when, okay, the core group of kids are kind of, they've got other things, they're busy, okay, so they can't make it. Mm-hmm. And so she tries to find a different group, and so goes through the same thing, gets them the booze, stuff like that, and then she leads them back to her place, because she wants something there.
Yeah.
And what do? They pull up beside her as they're following her, to her house, and I think they throw something out the window at her and call her a loser and stuff like that. And then she starts to break down.
Yeah.
Because it just pulls back and tears open those wounds all over again. And you feel like, you know, she just wants to be loved.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I think as well, without those flashbacks as well, you wouldn't necessarily have that relatability to what she's had to go through as well in her early days. So I think it was absolutely vital that they included that in the movie. I would have just liked to have seen a little bit more of it as well. But with that being said, let's get into the ratings and let's get into our final thoughts.
Final thoughts.
So, as always, we will start off with the critics' scores. IMDb rated this movie at 5.6 out of 10. Metacritic scored it 53. The Rotten Tomatoes critics scored it at 55%, with the Rotten Tomatoes audience scoring it at 64%. So, Jade, what would you give Ma out of 10?
Out of 10? I'd probably give it an 8, truth be told.
Okay. I'm finding it more and more difficult to rate movies the further on that I go. I think I'm probably going to give this movie a 7. I do think that there are certain issues that I have with this movie. I enjoy this movie. I certainly think there's a lot more good in this movie than bad. But, you know, when I look at some of the movies that we've given an 8 to before, or, you know, in and around that sort of score, we're looking at things like Scream and Hellraiser and It Chapter One, and I don't think that Ma quite hits that mark as well. So I'm going to give it a 7.
I will have to completely, you know, admit, I guess, as a disclaimer, if it's a horror movie and you put it on in front of me, I'm probably going to be a happy camper, so I might not be the best judge there. But for me, where it delivers, and I think is the strongest, is it's not a movie that you put on because it's a horror movie. You put it on because it's a movie full of characters that really you want to know more about, you find relatable, the plot and principle is intriguing enough to kind of capture you straight away, but also I find that the interactions between the characters are genuine. I find that, you know, Ma, as you know, as I've talked about before, you know, she has some aspects to her backstory that really, you know, that any of us can relate to. So it's something that I feel has a little bit of something for everyone, whereas with a lot of core horror movies, you know, they're there because you're a horror fan. A lot of people are looking either for, okay, I definitely want the jump scares, that's why I like it, or I really, really want to see, get, you know, somebody get cut up, or, you know, I want to see, you know, like a movie that's gonna, you know, scare me out of my pants and leave me feeling completely uneasy and sick. It's usually because those are the type of people that already want it. You're not going to have a movie, you know, you're not going to pull it off of a shelf. Whereas Ma, like you were talking about earlier, I feel like you could just put it on.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you there. What I will say is I do think the critics have rated this movie lower, significantly lower than I think it should be. I think they've been overly harsh on this film completely, and I do think it maybe deserves just a little bit more credit than they've perhaps given. And I would actively encourage anyone to go and watch this movie. And like you were saying as well, you know, so many horror films people watch because they're campy, because they're fun, because they have crazy kills and lots of blood and guts and gore. And if that's the style of horror that you're into, then great. You know, go and watch those movies. That's not what you're going to get here, but that doesn't make it a worse film. So I think, yeah, I think the critics have been particularly harsh. I do think this should have been rated slightly higher than it was. What I will say is, given our ratings and those of the critics, it gives Ma an average score of 6.1 out of 10. So we've dragged that score up just a little bit. It puts it in 35th place in terms of movies that we've covered on the show. It puts it one place above Cabin Fever and one place below Sinister.
Cabin Fever was so good.
Yeah, the critics were not a fan though. They did not like that movie. They dragged that score way, way down. But yeah, so it's in the bottom half of movies that we've covered in the show. I don't necessarily think it deserves to be bottom half. I think it deserves to be perhaps in the top half, but I do think it's not, if you're looking for the best of horror, maybe Ma's not going to be one that you're going to throw in there.
Yeah, I don't see it being on anybody's top 10 list.
Awesome. Well, that's it then. That's all we have got time for in this week's episode. Jade, thank you so much for joining me. I was absolutely honored to have you on.
It was an absolute pleasure, Ian. I mean, I had a lot of fun. It's nice to be able to interact with you a little more directly. Obviously, you know, you're busy with the podcast and you have a lot on your plate. And then, of course, Lori and I both with our creative endeavors. And then I have obviously a day job on top of that. So, you know, time is definitely not the most forthcoming for me. And then, you know, notwithstanding the 5 hours between us, you know, time difference, but... thank you so much. Honestly, it was a really good time. Would love to do it again sometime if, you know, for any reason you decided to call me back. But, you know, you've got a good thing going on here, and I hope that the listeners enjoyed the episode.
Dude, you're absolutely more than welcome onto this podcast whenever you want. I'm sure we can definitely organize that and get you back on the show at some point in the future. So you're absolutely welcome to do that at any point. Before we go, do you just want to remind everyone where they can find you on the socials, where they can find you on your Twitch?
Sure, absolutely. Twitch.tv/CoyoteWildfire or Coyote Wildfire, pretty much anywhere on social media, Instagram and Twitter primarily. And then we have a Discord, but you know, it would be by invite. So if you decide to tune into my streams, I can get you an invite there. But yeah, Coyote Wildfire if you want to find me.
Awesome. Don't forget @ScreamsBehind for us on Twitter. Search for Behind the Screams podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Subscribe to us on Patreon. Go to www.patreon.com/behindthescreams. Subscribe to us for as little as £1, and you can get a whole variety of perks from shout outs. And I'll just shout out to our current new Patreons on the show. Big thank you to Boomer and to Graham B. They have both signed up to us to support us on our Patreon. So thank you to them. We really, really do appreciate it and appreciate all the support they can get. Go rate and review us on iTunes as well. It's one of the best ways of getting the word out about the show to everyone else. But once again, thank you to Jade for joining us on this week's show. Thank you to every one of you who has listened and downloaded this episode. And we hope you will join us next time on Behind the Screams.